This week on Retronauts, winners don't take drugs, winners kill drugs! Hello, and welcome back to Retronauts. Thank you for joining us on this very special episode. No, I'm sorry, it's not episode 420, and no, I'm sorry, we didn't record on April 20th. I didn't plan that far ahead, but know this. It's a very special episode because we're talking about NARC. That's N-A-R-C, a video game of some acclaim, and a second video game that's, well, we'll talk about it because it's called NARC, and just we can't omit it, you know, as much as we'd like to. But this is your host, Diamond Fight, high as a kite. And joining me this week are two very special guests, starting in the great state of North Carolina.
Hey, it's me, Jeremy Parrish. I thought this episode was about narcolepsy, and I was just here to take a nap. So this might be a little difficult.
Please do not nod off, Jeremy. Do everything you can. Take this needle, Jared. We'll keep you awake. And joining us
is it Ketracel
North...
White?
Oh, no. You do not want to get hooked on Ketracel White. That will not end well. Joining us north of the border somewhere. I don't know where.
I'm David Oxford. I don't do drugs myself, but I'm not against it. So I guess you could say I'm going to meet you midway.
All right. Oh, me.
No, this was a Williams game, wasn't it?
Well, it's all. By the time this game came out, I think they were all one happy company, I think.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
But yes, we are here to talk about the video game NARC, which means we have to talk about drugs, which means we're making a little bit, some jokes about drugs. But let's get very serious here, because, you know, as often in the show, we have to talk about, you know, where we're coming from, what we've experienced, what our history is. So everyone, please lean into the microphone. Give your full address and tell the police where you keep your drugs. Jeremy, you go first. No, I'm seeing Jeremy's doing the Vince McMahon neck waving thing. No. Okay. Bad idea.
No, I was just trying to to, you know, reach the spliff in my collar. No, I actually, this probably won't surprise anyone, have never done any kind of illegal narcotic in my life, or even really legal ones. Like, alcohol is as hardcore as I've gotten. Well, that's not true. I did go see Osric Tentacles at the Fillmore once, and the instant the lights went down, I became incredibly high with secondhand marijuana smoke, because everyone there except me lit up. But that's that's really as close as it's become, I've just never felt compelled to try any of that stuff. And I don't have issues with people who practice, you know, taking drugs in a safe and responsible manner. It's just not a thing for me. Nancy Reagan would be so proud.
Oh, boy. Yeah, we'll get to her. We'll get to her in a minute. As for me, well, you know, obviously these days I'm clean, of course, but certainly in the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, I was a single person. I lived in a studio apartment and I worked for the post office, which means I had a lot of disposable income. And you know what? Me and my friends, we had time for video games, we had time for movies, and we had time to get high. And the irony of that is that, you know, given that I played a lot of NARC as a child, I was very much on board with this message at the time, because I was being inundated with said message, both in the media, at school, from actual cops, and everyone was sort of coming together to tell me, hey, kid, drugs are bad. And I believed them for a very long time, until I took the drugs and said, you know what? This doesn't seem that bad. I gotta be honest. You know, I didn't report myself to the police that day, but I felt like, you know what? I think you guys may have deceived me. But it's fine. I don't begrudge them. I'm sure it was just them doing their job. And I'd rather they did that job instead of, you know, the job they're doing these days, which I don't really want to talk about. But yikes, you know, we're recording this in the midst of some really, really scary videos that are going around the internet. And, you know, I'm from New York. And boy, I saw clips of what people describe on Twitter as an evil fire truck loaded with officers scaling a building. And I'm just like, what is how many libraries had to close to buy that thing, you know? But
yeah, this is an episode that's going to wrinkle people who are like, you should leave politics out of games. Well, maybe you should have told that to Eugene Jarvis, because this game is inherently political. There's no getting around it. So it's going to be discussed.
Yes. David, do you have anything you want to confess or deny as need be?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know if I ever would have tried drugs or not, because nobody ever offered me. So
okay.
That probably says some things right there.
Well, David, if you don't mind me asking, by the tone of your voice, it sounds like you are from the United States originally. Is that true?
That is correct.
Okay. So I'm assuming, you know, you're of probably a similar age to myself and Jeremy, maybe a bit younger. I don't know. You've got some spark in your eyes. I can't tell. But I'm assuming you grew up, you know, at some point during the 80s, you were a child.
Yes, that is correct.
All right.
And I need to find a better way to answer questions than that over and over. But yeah, I was totally an 80s kid.
Okay.
Until it became the 90s, then I was a 90s kid.
that's to be expected. So I ask that because the bulk of what's happening here, especially with the original arcade game, but also the climate that led up to the arcade game, means we have to discuss today, you know, the ins and outs, the overall big picture of America's war on drugs, which is a very expensive and big topic, but, you know, we're not behind the bastards here. I'm not going to do a deep dive or anything. You know, this is not the focus of the podcast, but we have to just lay some background here to sort of explain why this video game is the way it is and where it came from. And because if you were a kid in the 80s, this is what was happening. It was everywhere. You talked about it. As I alluded to earlier, you know, as a child in schools, I was actively being fed this line, and in some cases by actual police officers who came to the school and said, hey, kids, you know what's bad? Drugs. And I'm here to tell you not to do drugs. So how did we get there? Well, we've done a fair amount of complaining on this podcast about Ronald Reagan. And, you know, that's justified. But today, we need to start by complaining about Richard Nixon. So it's a complete change of pace.
Yes, those two have nothing in common.
I wish they were probably bridge partners. No, because Nixon, we have Nixon to thank for the actual term of war on drugs, because it really started with him in 1971. He made a speech about the fact that drug abuse is public enemy number one. There's a very good chance he said this because he just read about the drug abuse that was rampant, apparently, with our armed forces in Vietnam. You know, to think they were sent to a foreign country against their will, and the real problem is they were getting high. So that was, you know, that was the priority for Nixon. And over the course of several years, he would create agencies. The agency would fold into each other. He'd create policies. And basically, by the end of his first term, you have the actual DEA, as we know it today. That's the Drug Enforcement Agency. And as far as I know, they're still the top of the food chain in the United States as far as pursuing drug criminals and organizations and, in theory, keeping these drugs off the streets, you know, as mandated by the law.
You know, it's kind of a funny name when you think about it. It almost sounds like they're enforcing the use of drugs.
I mean, they went through many names, you know. I mean, the first one that he creates is the Office of Drug Abuse Law Enforcement, which is ODAL, which just does not go off the thing. So I think someone told him, you know what, we got the FBI, we got the CIA, we need three letters, Nixon.
Yeah, ODAL sounds like your great-grandfather's name. It just has that old timey ring to it.
And just for the record, just to show that we're you know, we're not heartless and we're not just complaining about this because we think drugs aren't so bad. From the start, there are rumblings and misgivings and quotes that suggest that this whole thing really isn't about the drugs. You know, many years later, one of Nixon's aides actually went on record saying that the whole idea was because by combating drugs, which were popular with people who protested against the war and a lot of minority groups, this was a way for the administration to strike back against those people, because the administration really, really didn't like protesters, and they certainly were not fans of people of color. Now, people have disputed this quote. Certainly, other people who were privy to those talks deny this outright. But we also have recordings that Richard Nixon made by himself in his office, talking about people who protested and weren't white. And these are really, really shocking conversations if you hear them from a sitting president. So it's not that he liked people of color, but he certainly, maybe he didn't hate them to create the DEA, but he sure did create the DEA. And as we'll see, the DEA spent a lot of its time and effort combating the communities that weren't white. That's just what happened. So I'm shrugging, folks, you know?
It's a curious coincidence. How strange that a man who was privately racist would create agencies and policies that would target the sort of people that he personally did not like. Nixon now, Nixon now.
Now, we go through sort of a whirlwind of change here because Richard Nixon, paragon of law enforcement, actually resigns somewhat in shame in 1974, not because of drugs, because of other criminal activity. And his replacement doesn't really go hard in the war of drugs things. His replacement, Jimmy Carter, actually pushes back against all of this. Richard, it's kind of amazing to read that Jimmy Carter, running for president in 1976, actually seemed sympathetic to the idea that drug addiction is a problem that needs to be solved, you know, not with, you know, legal ramifications, but with, you know, hospitals. And the idea that, you know, maybe some possession of some substances maybe could be decriminalized. He doesn't get around to actually enacting this policy because, you know, Jimmy Carter has his own problems. But the next two presidents after Nixon surely do not seem to grab his baton and run with it. They seem to be saying, I think we've got bigger problems to deal with here in the United States in the 1970s. But then a man, a certain man, arrives in our lives, you know, riding on a horse, holding a chimpanzee. His name is Ronald Reagan. And really, within days, I think, within days of him coming to office, everything gets serious. You know, we have a quote here from Ronald Reagan. I won't do the impression, even though I have Ronald Reagan on film. I have this. Ronald Reagan said, "We're taking down the surrender flag that's been flown over so many drug efforts. We're running up the battle flag." And Ronald Reagan would spend most of the next 8 years of his life gradually increasing and strengthening our policies against drugs and empowering, quote unquote, our law enforcement to do more and combining them with our military and all of this coming together. And just, wow, it's made a big mess that we are still dealing with today, even as many municipalities and some states outright have pushed back against these laws. Other states just have them all in the books. Other countries, I think, followed our lead and have very strict laws against drugs still being enforced.
Tell us about living in Japan, Diamond.
Yeah, I'm not going to point fingers. I don't know if they looked at Reagan and said, oh, we should do that too. I honestly don't know, but I can tell you right now that here in Japan, it is a very serious crime to have any drugs on you whatsoever. I am confident that if I was arrested and I had any sort of thing like that, I would probably just be deported. There probably wouldn't be a trial. There would probably just be, you need to leave. So I am not touching any of that, to be clear.
Yeah, I just put together a video on Strider for NES that spends like 10 minutes of its running length just talking about policy changes that were enacted once Reagan took office. And it really is remarkable how much of the state of America today can be traced back to him. And really just like the first year of his administration back when he was, you know, still all there and capable of acting quickly and decisively on things. It's weird because, you know, my earliest memories of life, of existence, really start in 1980 or so. Like, I remember some fuzzy things before that. But, like, you know, when you have memories going back to a certain point in history, you tend to think of that as like the starting point for everything because that's where you started. I think it's just a natural tendency for people to be like, oh, everything before that was like, you know, prehistory. Who knows? It's so nebulous and weird. But I really do feel that there was a radical or maybe reactionary change in American society right around 1980. And so much of everything that we sort of take for granted today or have to live with today really began right there. And of course, you know, it has decades, centuries of precedent leading up to that point. But I just feel like you can really drop a pin at the first couple of years of Reagan's administration and say, this is the point where things changed. And I don't know, maybe that's solipsism speaking, but I just feel like so much about American society changed. Some for the good, you know. I mean, suddenly we had computers in the home, which has mostly been good. It's just like everything really, just the sound of things, the look of things, the attitudes about things, the policies about things, the technology of things really did, you know, once the 80s came in, it really, just looking back at history, does seem like a massive break with things that had come before, like a kind of, you know, here's a new chapter of history. It's like, in a bad way, like the New Testament versus the Old Testament. But I don't want to pin Reagan as Jesus, because let's not take that analogy any further. But anyway, the point I'm saying is, like, that dude really, mostly for the worse, but better or worse, mostly the worse, enacted a lot of change in America that had, and the world, that has had lasting ramifications nearly, you know, 45 years later. It's been a long time, but we're still kind of living with the aftershocks of all that.
Yeah, Jeremy, I have to actually credit you on this because, you know, I put together a sort of timeline of the war on drugs here, and you added a single note which really struck me as timely. You pointed out that in 1981, Ronald Reagan passed the Military Cooperation with Civilian Law Enforcement Agencies Act, which, you know, the short version is it enabled our armed forces to more closely cooperate with our police forces, which goes against the precedent from earlier in American history, which was a big deal because we actually wrote, you know, we wrote several documents about this to keep the police and military separate. But as part of this war on drugs, they wanted to have more, you know, military action because they perceived it as an actual war. They said, okay, well, we need the military involved. Also, they were also very concerned about drugs that were coming in from overseas, so they needed to send the military overseas, and they had military actions going on in other countries where they thought the drugs were, you know, they thought they would cut them off the source. And again, as I said, we're seeing a lot of things going on in the United States as we speak, where you've got soldiers and police officers working together. Again, I'm from New York City. They've got soldiers in the subways these days apparently doing random bag checks, and I'm like, what is going on here? I mean, and it's a Democratic governor of New York State who says these things, and it's like, you know, people go up there.
And a Democratic,
like,
mayor.
Yeah, Democratic mayor, Democratic governor, everyone up across the board. This is a blue state, but they all decide, well, you know what? We're worried about crime, and we're going to do this against crime. And everyone's like, does this actually help solve crime? And even the governor's like, well, it'll help us feel better about crime. And I'm just yeah. here shaking my head. I'm just,
Let's spend millions in, law enforcement salaries to catch a few thousand dollars worth of fare evaders. That's the way to live. That's good policy.
It's really shocking. And this goes all the way back. It really does.
Yes. Okay. So let me say one more thing about the military.
Please.
Cooperation with Civilian Law Enforcement Agencies Act. The line between the military and the police really began to blur with Nixon, I would say. And that's when you had things like Kent State and, you know, cops in riot gear. You started seeing SWAT teams formed where special weapons and tactics basically meant these are cops who, you know, have military training, military equipment, etc. But yeah, the 1981 Act was really, again, just a huge leap in that really, you know, took its battering ram and had a squad of dudes breaking down the doors between the military and the police. And, you know, at this point, looking at Columbia University and so forth, the line between the military and the police is incredibly thin. You started in the late 90s seeing, due to more legislation, which incidentally came about under Bill Clinton, a Democratic president, like both sides are guilty of this, really started to... Basically, surplus military gear could be sold to law enforcement agencies. And that led to what you have now, which is basically you know, every guy who goes to the police academy for a few months thinks that he is somewhere like a cross between the Punisher and a super soldier. And that's, you know,
like a super cop, basically.
Yeah, basically. Uh-huh. Yeah. Ice cream soldier.
From RoboCop without the robo.
Exactly. So, again, the early 80s, the first year of Reagan's administration, just kicked in the door and said, everything's changing now.
And part of that, it wasn't all guns and riot shields. Part of this was also a sort of, how do I put this? A kid first approach as well. Very famously in 1982 at a photo op, the president's wife, Nancy Reagan, was asked by a child, what should I do if someone tries to give me drugs? And reportedly off the cuff, Nancy Reagan told this child, just say no. And This quote became a catchphrase. This would dominate, really, I would say, the rest of her life, certainly the rest of her term as first lady. And it just became a quotable thing. There were PSAs, there were commercials. She would go on actual, you know, sitcoms and just appear as herself and say, "Hey kids, you shouldn't be doing drugs. If people try to give you drugs, just say no." And that just became a refrain for many, many years to come. And related to that, you have in Los Angeles, completely uncontroversial police chief Daryl Gates, working together with the superintendent of schools.
Star of a video game himself.
Yes. Yes, yes, Police Squad. Not Police Squad. That's the Los Angeles. Police Quest, excuse me.
I would actually Police Squad starring Daryl Gates. That's
yes.
Maybe it could be interesting, maybe it could be a true atrocity. I don't know.
But these guys got together and they created something called DARE. That's an acronym. That's D-A-R-E, the Drug Abuse Resistance Education. Now, it's not just a bad acronym, folks. It's also a play on his name because it's Daryl. Yes, not just Daryl Strawberry. It's Daryl Gates. This guy was a huge tool. He's dead now.
What does Daryl stand for? D-A-R-Y-L. There was a movie. I think it was about him.
Oh, robot youth life form, I think.
Okay.
It's been a long time since I saw that one.
Analyzing robot youth life form or something.
Yeah. It's an 80s kids classic because you've got lots of people with guns chasing a child in the woods. But it's okay because the kids are
robots. That's very much like our modern era.
It's a funny thing. I definitely remember the DARE program, but I remember for the longest time, I had no idea what it actually stood for because, like, you'd see the letters there, but I don't remember them ever putting the, you know, abbreviation anywhere near it.
I thought the periods were just bullet holes. I had no idea it was an acronym.
I mean, you got to give them credit where it's due. They came up with this bad nickname, but they had a very strong branding. They had a logo that everyone could easily recognize. They went into schools. They gave away tons of stuff, school supplies with this logo on it. It's black with red text. It looks super cool. I'm sure I had a ruler that said DARE on it for most of elementary school and probably most of middle school too. Like, it was everywhere. You know, they were giving away t-shirts. I'm sure most people wear these t-shirts ironically these days, but in the 80s, we were wearing them as children unironically. We're just like, yeah, I've been told to stay away from drugs. That's why I'm wearing this t-shirt. But yeah, DARE started in LA as an LA thing, but eventually expanded to all 50 states and even the UK. They even came to the UK in the 90s, which is kind of amazing to me, but I would love to hear what they were saying over there. Probably, I don't know. I'm imagining something with fish and chips just because I'm terrible that way. Did DARE work? We have no evidence that it worked. In fact, we have some evidence that it did the opposite because when you're sending police into school and telling children about drugs and telling them how they need to avoid drugs, there's at least a decent number of people who learned about drugs because the police came to school and told them about the drugs. So obviously it's impossible to clinically analyze this. They've had some studies that say one or the other, but we have quotes from people. My favorite is this one from Professor Richard Morin, who says, "Dare is the world's biggest pet rock. If it makes us feel good to spend the money on nothing, that's okay. But everyone should know that Dare does nothing."
Do we need to explain pet rocks for the listeners? Because it does predate the 1980s.
That's another 70s innovation. But as far as I know, pet rocks never killed anyone.
I guess if you throw it from a high enough building, yeah. My pet rock jumped off the Empire State Building, and now I'm in jail. So I will say, you know, you mentioned something about the UK. Bear in mind that at the same time Reagan came to office, Margaret Thatcher came to power. And mm-hmm. she was actually probably more enthusiastic about fascism than Reagan was. So I can't imagine that, you know, their growing up was really that different over there for them. Except, you know, with more austerity.
We also, if we're talking about drugs in the 80s and law enforcement and the image of all these things together, we have to mention the fact that in 1985, the hot new drug that everyone's talking about is crack. Crack suddenly becomes a national epidemic, or at least a media epidemic. I can't tell you how many people were actually using it, but there were certainly some high profile deaths, some young men who overdosed on cocaine. You know, the most famous case is Len Bias, a NBA prospect who was drafted by the Celtics and then died a few days later. Very tragic loss of life, but these deaths only underscored the fact that people perceived America, and especially American cities, as overrun with crime and overrun with drugs. Now, I was still, you know, a child who would go to New York City on multiple occasions, and while I certainly know the city had a bad reputation, and there are probably some parts of the city that I should not go as a child, so I didn't go there, I certainly didn't go there and experience any violence or, you know, even half as bad as the stuff you would see, you know, as portrayed in films or on television or as talked about in the newspaper. But that was the perception. That was what was going on. People were talking about this like things were falling apart. And the push against drugs and the push to get drugs away from everyone as far as, you know, keep them away from people, especially children, got stronger and stronger as the 80s wore on. More legislation, more, you know, mandatory sentences. And again, because crack cocaine was very popular in the cities and popular with not white people, suddenly you had a double standard where possessing a minuscule, a microscopic amount of crack could get you a minimum sentence of 5 years in prison, whereas you needed to have 500 grams, like a pound of cocaine to get a similar sentence in court. And it's like, that's fact. That's not like me making up things. Like, that's the actual law that they wrote.
Yeah, see also the Duran Duran song White Lions talks all about that.
I think that was Grandmaster Flash, but yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I've heard the Duran Duran song. It does make sense that it would have been a cover of Grandmaster Flash, because that was a sort of social cause that he really took up and broadcast.
A street kid gets arrested, gonna do some time. He got out 3 years from now just to commit more crime. A businessman is caught with 24 kilos. He's out on bail and out of jail, and that's the way it goes.
Cane, sugar, cane.
Athletes rejected, governors corrected. Gangsters, thugs, and smugglers are thoroughly respected. The money gets divided, the women get excited. Now I'm broke and it's no joke, it's hard as hell to fight it, don't buy it.
But also important to all this, we should mention this, as NARC, as the arcade game that we're going to talk about today, started hitting arcades, we also had a cooperation between the FBI and the American Amusement Machine Association, the AAMA, aka the agency in charge of basically almost all arcade games that were being brought into the United States or made in the United States. And that's because the head of the AAMA was a former FBI agent, a man named Bob Fay. So Bob Fay and the director of the FBI, William Sessions, get together. They're trying to brainstorm, hey, what do we do here? How do we get this message to kids that they need to stop taking drugs? And they come up with the idea of, well, what if we put a loading screen on every arcade game in the country and it says, winners don't use drugs? And that's where it started. You first started to see it in 1989. So ironically, NARC does not make the cut. NARC probably came out, we think, late 88, early 89, so it just missed it. But in the years that followed, every machine, and I mean every machine, would have this message. And after a few years, again, ironically, Sessions would be fired for alleged misuse of funds, but the message endured. The message endured well into the early 2000s. They just took his name off it. So for over a decade, hundreds and hundreds of classic arcade games to the ROMs to this day, if you boot them up on emulators, you will see this message. They will remind you not to take drugs, and it's only the American version. The Japanese version doesn't say this, even though Japanese, you know, people were as much, if not more, terrified of drugs coming to their schools.
You know, I meant to bring this up earlier when you brought up the punishment in Japan. It wasn't very long ago. I think one of the voice actors for one of the recent Yakuza Like a Dragon games ended up they basically just kind of like removed him from the game, his likeness and voice and everything, just because, gosh, what was he just in possession? I'm trying to remember the specifics.
He was I believe he had cocaine on his person. I think it was cocaine. I believe his, I'm not gonna look it up, but I believe his stage name was Pierre Takigawa. I think that was him. And yeah, he was arrested and charged with possession. And as what often happens here in Japan, when you're arrested of a crime, almost any crime, but especially a drug crime, yeah, all of Japanese society and especially Japanese media basically rubs out your entire body of work. There was a popular duo of musicians who produced a lot of hit songs, and one of them got arrested for drugs. Suddenly their back catalog disappeared from streaming. Pierre actually had a recent comeback. I saw him on a Netflix streaming show. So he's not dead. He's not out of work. But yes, he was in a video game, his likeness and his voice, and they removed him completely for the overseas launch and eventually the domestic launch as well. So that's also the case. In fact, another actor I could think of, I forgot his name, but he played Jotaro in the live-action JoJo's Bizarre Adventure movie, and he was arrested for marijuana, and all of a sudden his career basically ended, and that movie is still available, but you bet your ass if they ever make another movie, they're not going to cast him again. They will have to recast it, because you can't have him back.
Yeah, Japan definitely, my understanding is, comes down way harder on drug-related offenses, like the minuscule possession, much harder than a lot of other offenses. Like, you know, there's comic artists who get arrested for child porn possession and they end up, you know, continuing on with their career. And I feel like that is a much more heinous crime, in my personal opinion, than half a gram of marijuana. But what do I know? I think Paul McCartney get banned from Japan for a while?
He was arrested in Japan because he arrived on a flight and he had weed with him. This was a very long time ago. This is not like 80-year-old sure. Paul McCartney. This was young.
He probably would still have weed with him, and you know, as he travels,
possibly. But yeah, it was a very famous story. He arrived in Narita. He just came overseas. He had drugs on him, and I believe they arrested him and just told him to leave. And he eventually came back, but certainly not that year, or maybe even that decade. I don't know how long it was, but it was a big deal, and it was a big story.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty unilateral for them. It's, you know, blanket across the spectrum, no matter how famous you are.
Yeah, and I can tell you, to this day, if you arrive at a Japanese airport, you will see lots of signs, and maybe even a person will come up to you and tell you and show you a picture card and saying, "Hello, do you know the drugs are illegal? Do you have any drugs in your suitcase? Can you show me your suitcase? Do you have drugs?" And, you know, I just kind of laugh at it a little bit because, like, I don't have drugs, and if I did, I wouldn't tell you I had drugs, but whatever. It's just, you know.
I've never had that happen to me before. Maybe I just look too clean cut, too churchy.
All right, let's move on from the unpleasant real-life drug stuff and talk about the fun drug stuff, the silly drug stuff that we're here to talk about, which is NARC, which is a arcade game made in 1988, released at the end of that year. It rolled out slowly over the course of that year in the early 1989. And it comes to us from Williams, a.k.a. Midway, a.k.a. Bally, some some three of those words come together. It's a mishmash. I honestly can't keep them straight, but they were all coming together at that, around that point. So it's all fair. Like if you bought this game on, say, PlayStation 2 or Xbox many years later as a compilation, it would have been called a Midway collection. So it's like, you're not wrong to think of him as Midway. David's joke is 100% correct.
It was a good joke, and I apologize for raining on it. That was like a humor narc moment, and I don't want to be that person. So I apologize.
All good. All good.
Now, obviously, as with many things in life, it doesn't come down to just one person responsible for an arc, but there is one person who comes down first when it comes to an arc, and that is Eugene Jarvis. And Eugene Jarvis, by the way, even in 1988, already kind of a star as far as video game developers go, because he was behind the huge hit Defender in the early 80s, as well as, I think he also did Robotron, and shortly after NARC, he was part of the Smash TV. I know he was at least tangentially related to Mortal Kombat. Like, he did a lot of arcade games and pinball games, so this was just one of many, many hits for young Eugene Jarvis. I think he was probably in his late 20s at this point, maybe 30. Like, he came to the company very young. So even at this point, he's still a very young man and still, you know, both an up-and-comer and a very established voice. It's a weird place to be.
Yeah, in 1988, when this game came out, some people might have heard of Shigeru Miyamoto from, like, you know, a profile with some guy you've never heard of in Japan talking about video games and Nintendo Power. But he was not a household name. He wasn't famous. He wasn't, like, the superstar video game creator. Whereas Eugene Jarvis, like, industry-wide, everyone knew him. So, yeah, it was a different era.
He did Joust, too, right?
No, that was John Newcomer.
Was it? Okay, I thought Jarvis was involved in that. Okay, my bad.
He might have, like, been a producer or something on it. I don't know exactly, but the design on Joust was John Newcomer. I've made that mistake before, and I've been corrected, so I will never forget.
All right.
Well, it's appropriate, Jeremy, you mentioned John Newcomer, because John Newcomer is also with the team from NARC. We also have George Petro, who's been a part of a lot of famed Midway, Bally, Williams games, and Mark Lofredo. Mark Lofredo was also part of this. Those are the four names that came up the most in my research as far as this game goes. Obviously, more than four people make a video game, but those are the names that came up the most often. And as arcade games go, NARC actually had a fairly long cycle of development. They say they started in 1986, and they said they started and they wanted to go high-tech, because by 1986, the NES has already arrived. It's not quite a Super Smash hit, but it's certainly... it's out there in the United States, and I think people could tell, certainly the arcade business, they could tell that consoles are getting better and they're getting faster, and we need to compete with that. So they had on their list, they wanted to make a new arcade game that would really get people's attention, wow them, and show people something that they couldn't play at home. And indeed, many years later, if you look at the NES game, like, you really couldn't compare the NES version to the arcade version. They're two totally different animals.
Yeah, also you had really cool-looking arcade games coming in from Japan. 1985 saw the beginning of Super Scalar games from Sega, and yes. Namco was churning out equivalent games. I can't remember which system that is. So, you know, the Japanese arcade makers, who didn't have to deal with the realities of the Atari crash that we kind of had to struggle through here in America, were just firing on all cylinders. So that was another form of competition, like... you know, arcades and home consoles were really, I think, posing an existential threat to arcades and arcade operators and developers. So, yeah, they definitely were correct in their assessment that they really needed to step it up.
I remember that NARC for the NES was a thing, but it was a thing that I never bothered touching because I was familiar with the arcade game, and it's like, you look at the layout there, you look at the NES controller, and it's like, there's no way that's going to work.
No, you'll see, when we get to the ports, you'll see that's actually a trend, I would say. Most of the ports suffer because of the fact that the arcade had a very specific setup that it required four different buttons. And a lot of systems at the time simply didn't have that many buttons on their joysticks. Or if they did, they required you to push maybe one button for two different functions, which is just, you know... inelegant, to put it in a phrase.
Kind of surprising that we didn't get a Super NES version, since, you know, that system had one the color depth necessary to pull off Narc's graphics, if not the resolution. And also, it had enough buttons on the controller. And, you know, the Midway Williams, whoever, definitely made a lot of money making games for Super NES, but maybe they came into it a little later, and by that point, Narc was dusty and old? I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to bring up...
I think it just missed the cut, because... Oh. I'm sorry, David.
Yeah, I was going to bring...
Please continue.
I was going to bring up the Super NES thing. I wasn't sure if it was too soon, but yeah, it's funny that it never arrived there, but for those reasons, and... It was a claim that was doing a lot of the ports for Midway at that point, so maybe that had something to do with it, too.
Well, I can tell you that Narc arrived for the NES in 1990, so that was the same year the Super Nintendo debuted in Japan, and it came to America 1 year later, so I feel like they had just made it, so that I think no one decided, oh, well, let's do it again. So, bad timing, probably.
Yeah.
But what was not bad timing, I should say, is their decision, one of the things they just came up with to make this game more attractive, more stunning, more eyeball attention, is they decided, let's have this game star real people. So all the characters you see on the screen in this game, including the dogs, they were all photographed and digitized. So it's a very early example of digitized graphics. Again, this is 88, so it's at least a year before Pit Fighter, and almost three full years before Mortal Kombat, which, of course, is also part of the Midway, Bally, Williams family. So, of course, you know, Eugene Jarvis was also involved in that thing, too. So this is, in some small way, a brief stepping stone that would lead to Mortal Kombat down the line. Not a direct A to B. Call it A to MK.
Yeah, the visuals in this game are really interesting because they used, according to Wikipedia, it's a medium resolution monitor, which means it was, you know, much, much higher resolution than the 256 by 240 or whatever, 320 by 240 that you normally saw. And it had really great color depth, but I don't think the memory and the artistry were quite there to take full advantage of that. So the game really reminds me visually of a Mac shareware title from the mid-90s, because you also had that same, like, great color depth, high resolution compared to PC games, DOS games at the time. But, you know, creating art assets is very expensive and time-consuming, so they had this tendency to be a little stiff and sparse. And, yeah, it just, you know, like, the two categories, Mac games and Narc, feel of a piece to me.
Well, it certainly did require a lot of memory and a lot of energy. Indeed, one of the ideas initially was to have two different heroes, because it's a co-op game. And so they designed two different looking heroes to have in this game. But apparently, once they started getting things together, according to George Petro, the graphics just took up too much memory, so they couldn't do it. So that's why you have the solution where you have the sort of classic palette swap of blue guy and red guy in exactly the same outfit. And also, they're wearing motorcycle helmets because that way you don't have to see their faces. So, you know, not how they intended to solve this problem, but it worked. Because I think it overall gave the characters sort of a slight air of mystery. Like, who are these men who have all these guns and are unloading justice on the streets? And, you know... Are they handsome? Are they scary? Who knows? But they sure love to shoot people.
Yeah, I feel like adding the helmets to those guys is a creative choice that really kind of makes the game a lot more ominous. And, you know, the characters go from being Crockett and Tubbs to basically like Judge Dredd. It just makes it feel more... You know, like, officer, I need to see your badge number. Why is your badge covered with tape? What's going on?
Yes. Although, ironically, Jeremy, you can see each player's badge number on the sort of score screen. So they don't hide.
They didn't come up with that trick yet. Well, they didn't have body cams back then, so.
We'll be right back. funny you mentioned the mask thing, because obviously they, you know, according to Jarvis, they took a lot, they had a lot of plenty of material at the time to sort of funnel into this project. Jarvis calls out RoboCop, which of course came out the year before, and RoboCop certainly has a sort of visor over his face. You can't see his eyes. Dirty Harry was still very much, you know, in the limelight. They were still making Dirty Harry movies in the 80s. The Death Wish series was still going on. It was definitely getting long in the tooth, but they were still making Death Wish movies in the 80s. He also called out Michael Mann's Thief, which is kind of strange because it's not that much a murder in that movie, but it's certainly, you know, it was a big hit. And I guess if you liked it, you liked it. It had a great soundtrack, but I don't see a lot of connection there.
Maybe I'm alone in this, but in a way it kind of reminds me, and it precedes this, but it kind of reminds me of a really violent Power Rangers.
I mean, certainly the Super Sentai phenomenon was already big in Japan. I don't know if they would have seen that in the United States already, but you're right in that you've got, you know, you've got a set of heroes dressed identically, just different colors, and you can't see their faces because that way you don't have to hire, you know, you can hire a stuntman to do all the martial arts stuff, and then you can have a different actor, you know, do the drama stuff. Or in the case of Power Rangers, you can have white people play the main characters and then just cut to Japanese stuntmen doing the actual work.
Yeah.
I also have a very curious quote from Jarvis, who I really feel like this sums up NARC very, very well, who says, "The cool thing was we played it straight. So if you ask if NARC was satire or propaganda, you could take it either way. And really, it's both and neither at the same time." Which I just don't think that's how anything works, but also I can see how thinking that would inform the decision of how you make NARC. Because, yeah, when you play a video game like NARC, certainly when you played it at the time, like, to me as a child, it was, I read it as completely straight. Like, oh yeah, drugs are bad, I'm playing a guy, a cop, and I'm here to get rid of all the drugs. And as I got a little bit older, I was like, boy, it seems kind of messed up we had a game all about killing people over drugs. And especially if you view a few of Jarvis's later releases, I don't know that he was kidding. So, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he definitely leaned into the playing it straight approach to NARC later in his career.
Like, Smash TV.
But I don't know if that's...
Like, Smash TV is very jokey. Smash TV is definitely jokey that, you know, it almost steals the I'd buy that from... I think it does steal I'd buy that from a dollar from RoboCop, doesn't it? Doesn't he? Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then you look at the sequel to Smash TV, which is...
Total Carnage?
Total Carnage, yes. That's right. Sorry. And Total Carnage just seems like it's a blatant, like, Saddam Hussein, like, riff. Like, you're fighting a random Middle Eastern guy who's got a silly name, and it just seems kind of racist. I mean, it just... I don't know. I could see jokes maybe in NARC. Smash TV is definitely joking. I don't know that Total Carnage is actually joking about anything. So, yeah, I'm making a yeesh face and tugging my collar here.
with NARC, it's like I feel like the game plays it straight, like in universe, but a lot of the action and the characterization is so over the top that, you know, it's kind of hard to take seriously at the same time.
I read it as being pretty straight-laced. Like, it was an incredibly stupid, ridiculous game. But at the same time, there was so much of this, like, don't do drugs, you know, everything from Miami Vice to just news reports about crack cocaine epidemics in our nation's slums, that it was hard for me, you know, as a teenager, or even, I guess I was barely a teenager at that point, to read it as anything but like this is pretty straightforward. And maybe I just wasn't tuning into the irony of it, but you know, it was over the top and ridiculous, but that just kind of seemed gratuitous to me, as opposed to like don't take that. It didn't seem tongue-in-cheek, I guess is what I'm saying. And you know, movies were becoming increasingly violent at that point. RoboCop, that raised hackles for people because it was so graphically violent on screen. And that was a much more openly satirical film. But at the same time, despite being satire, it still really pushed the boundaries of what you could show in terms of violence on a, you know, a mainstream movie screen, movie theater screen. So, you know, there was definitely a cultural movement, a tendency toward genuine graphic violence in media at that point that was kind of pushing it into the mainstream. So, I think I always viewed NARC in that light and saw it as maybe satire, but also kind of not, kind of like, this is, you know, this is legit. So I don't know. That's kind of, speaking as someone who was there and remembers it all, that's kind of where I came from.
The bad guys to me feel like if, the WWF or WCW of the day were to, like, you know, have a bunch of wrestlers that were themed around drugs, they'd be the guys from NARC.
Well, if I may, I'd like to read a passage directly from the NARC arcade manual. So this is not a promotional flyer. This is something that only the people making, you know, operating the machine would read.
The gospel.
So, excuse me. I'm getting a character here. The city's overrun. Slashers. Gangsters. Pimps. The punks are everywhere. The scum of the earth. And only the player can restore law and order. Trigger finger spraying hot metal before him. Rocket bomb at the ready. The player is a macho urban gorilla, defending our city from the ultimate urban scourge. This is his neighborhood, too. He's committed. He says no to inner city decadence. He carries a badge and a moral code, and he backs them both with screaming lead. I don't know. Is that satire? I don't know if that is satire.
It's a bit lurid. It's pulpy.
Jarvis also credits the lead artist Jack Hager on the project. Jarvis says Hager came up with the slogan, "Say no or die," which is written on the sides of the cabinet.
I don't remember that part.
The Nancy Reagan slogan, still very much in the zeitgeist, even though Reagan is leaving office by the time this game really hits the mass market. What kind of game is NARC? We're talking about NARC in vague terms so far. What kind of game is NARC? Well, I would describe it as run and gun, except you're not really running. You're actually walking quite deliberately. It's a very, very deliberately paced game. Very straightforward. You're basically marching from left to the right. Virtually every level is just a very long hallway. Sometimes you encounter locked doors that require passes to open, color-coded passes. But there's only really one case I can think of where you had to find the pass and then double back and open a door. In most cases, you will find that pass as you march to the end, and that will just be the exit, and then you're safe. You get to go. Also interesting is that the characters can jump and crouch. This is why you have four buttons. You've got a jump button and a crouch button. Now, there's no platforming, really. You can jump over certain objects, but you're never going to, like, jump over a pit or anything. Crouching is more important because a lot of the enemies will attack high, so crouching will get you under their bullets. But as the game goes along, you'll find more and more enemies are attacking low as well, so you have to mix it up. Jump, crouch, move the diagonals, you know, stay mobile, you know, float like a butterfly. Don't slow down.
Yeah, during the first part.
So in that way, it's kind of like a beat 'em up, you know, kind of like a Double Dragon almost. You have to work multiple planes while also staying level to your foes, because obviously any bullets you fire are going to be straight ahead. You need a lot of your bullets, but then you need to move out of your way to dodge their bullets, which of course I love in NARC, all the bullets are these sort of like long hyphens, like rainbow colored hyphens that fly across the screen. They're very easy to see, which I think most bullets aren't. So I really appreciate that as an arcade game goer.
They're all tracers.
Yeah, you describe it as a run and gun, but like for the first part of the game when I'd played, it'd be more like a crouch and gun, because I would just not let off that button and just, you know, use that to kind of weave in and out and around everything.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think of the gunplay in Elevator Action, but instead of being a vertical game, it's just entirely horizontal. And going back to it and reviewing it, you know, for the first time in, I don't know how long, decades, I'm struck by how much it reminds me of Defender, which, you know, makes sense because Eugene Jarvis. But, you know, you're dealing with things left and right. There's an element of some verticality where you have to avoid bullets. But also, it uses a lot of Defender sound effects. And even, like, the kind of the typeface, you know, the fonts and the rainbow effects on them. Like, it's all – and all, the high resolution, like, it's higher resolution than other competing games at the time. It's all very much of a piece with Defender, which, you know, I guess this was kind of his attempt to sort of revisit that style of game in a more contemporary fashion. But I will say that I feel like this is – not a patch on Defender. Defender is a great game with brilliant design, and this is pretty dumb, and I don't just mean in terms of, like, the over-the-top aesthetics, but also just in terms of the gameplay. There's not as much to it.
Well, speaking of Defender, Jeremy, there's also a mini-map very prominently on the screen, which in later stages is quite useful because it can show you almost everything that's on this level, like your character, enemy characters, things you can pick up, and towards the end of the game, the last boss, you'll definitely want to see him coming on the radar, otherwise you'll be in big trouble. So, we mentioned run and gun, so what are the guns like? Well, you basically have two guns. There's no power-ups, but you need ammo. Your guns need ammo. Your basic gun is just, you know, you're shooting bullets. You can't actually run out of bullets, but if you have no ammo, you have to, I think, reload after every shot, so it really slows down your rate of fire, which can be a problem because this game, you know, especially in later levels, will throw a lot of enemies at you. They will storm the screen. So you really need to keep the bullets flying as fast as possible.
Kind of turns into a Barney Fife situation.
More importantly, however, is the aforementioned rocket bomb, rocket launcher, whatever you call it. And these are harder to come by, but a single rocket will launch in a straight line, and it explodes. It will kill almost anything in one hit. It will do splash damage. It will kill lots of enemies if they are bunched together. It will destroy enemy vehicles, which are a big problem later in the game, because that's the only way to stop them, really. They are essential for the last boss, so you have to really stock up on rockets, and you need to use them sparingly. You can't just fire them willy-nilly. Another reason you can't fire them willy-nilly is because a rocket can hit your partner. It's a co-op game. So if you rocket your partner, I don't know if it actually does damage, but it will certainly send them flying into the air, which will be a big problem for them. So you have to watch your shots in those regard.
They do make it really tempting, though, because when the rocket, like, hits a crowd of enemies, then just all these body parts go, identical body parts go flying and raining down and stuff. There's kind of a certain, what's the term I'm looking for? Just kind of a dark, humorous joy to it.
I mean, it's very much the same energy that Mortal Kombat would have a few years later, you know, punching a guy and having him explode into lots of little identical bones, you know?
Exactly.
Like, it's that. Yeah. It's also the bodies are charred. Like, they fly in the air, they come down, they're still on fire. It's, like, as a kid for me, when I played this game, I was, like, that's just, like, number one on a list of 1 million things that I loved. Because, like, oh my god, you blow people up. You just blow them up. You blow them up real good.
I think it's great that including a rocket launcher allows them to say this game has RPG elements. Sorry, I deliberately timed that for when you were drinking, Diamond.
All right, it's okay. I did not spit in my water. I didn't spit. Other important stuff, there is a car, which I think is probably a Miami Vice thing. You know, Miami Vice always had a very nice car. So you begin most stages in it looks like a Porsche to me. And you jump out of the Porsche, but some stages let you drive the Porsche. You'll find the Porsche. There's a very long bridge stage where you can find multiple Porsches along the way. You can drive the car. Nice. If you drive too fast and hit something, the car will explode and it'll hurt you, so don't do that. You can fire your guns from inside the car, which is very convenient. The car is not a shield, so enemies can still hit you. If they get close, they can stab you if they're like a stabby person. As also mentioned, the helicopters, enemy helicopters will come by. You don't want to be in the car when the helicopter comes by because they will drop a bomb on your car and blow it up. You can ram the helicopter with your car if you're fast enough and blow them both up together, but also blow yourself up, which isn't really practical. But it works. It'll work, is what I'm saying. You can kill helicopter with a car if you want to do that. It's an option.
Is it worth the quarter?
It's very Ikari Warriors.
And as you're moving the field, you're firing bullets, you're getting the enemies. So what are you doing? Well, this is a game about drugs. So as you kill people, they're dropping little baggies that are labeled as evidence. Okay, they're little bags of white powder. We don't know what's in them. We don't want to know. We just know they're evidence, and you collect them. And at the end of each stage, you get bonus points based on how much evidence you collect. Enemies also drop more ammo for your guns. Select enemies will drop more rockets. So keep an eye out for those things. Also, cash. They'll drop cash. There's no shop mechanic in the game, but evidence and cash are both valuable as bonus points. But the real charm, I would say, or I would say, like, point-wise, if you want to get a high score in this game, the real trick is you want to arrest people. You want to bust them. And to bust them, you must not shoot them. You must approach them very carefully, walk up to them, and put the cuffs on them. Now, there's no special button. It happens automatically, but it's not foolproof. Sometimes you need to get close to a guy and, like, wait for a few seconds, or he'll turn around and then walk away, and you have to do it again. But if you bust someone, they fly off the screen, you get all their evidence, and you get a 5,000 bonus point for each bust at the end of each stage. So you will rack up a huge amount of points in this game if you start busting people. And considering how the default settings give you an extra life every 100,000 points, if you get a high score in this game, you will get a lot of extra lives, and you can play for a really long time. So this, like, once you understand how this game works, I feel like you can get a very long, you get real some real power for your buck here, which is one reason why I played it over and over again over many years, because I always knew that I could get probably 4, 5, 6 minutes of a really good game going, and if I got lucky, I might even beat it. But I probably need some more change, because the last boss is a lot. We'll get to him. But I feel like it's actually a very fair game. Unlike Defender, where, like, I die in 45 seconds and I'm done. Just sorry.
That was my prime strategy back in the day. I was talking about, like, not letting up off the crouch button, just basically hold crouch and just, you know, walking over, like, everybody and rack up the points. I felt like some kind of, like, you know, like, savant or something when I discovered that.
So, who are these enemies? Who are these people? Who are we busting? Well, as you might have guessed, the whole theme is about drugs. So everyone in this game either sells drugs, or makes drugs, or uses drugs. So they're all equally bad, really. It's funny, even though all the people are are obviously actors, like real people photographed, I couldn't find any reliable online sources to tell who played all these people. And the credits don't say. At least some evidence indicated that Mark Lofredo on the development side was the model for some of these characters, but I don't know how many or which ones.
They didn't want to incriminate themselves.
But, you know, it starts off very simple with the Dassloaf gang, who are just your sort of standard trench coat guys. They've got guns. You know, they move very slowly. They're definitely easy in the early stages to just rack up the bust. You know, you'll get lots of points. You next make up the hypo man, Dr. Spike Rush, who struts around and literally throws giant syringes at you. And if you get stuck with them, like, you flash lots of colors. I guess they're getting you high for free. So, bad business model, but I guess it kills you too. So, I don't know.
I just want to say that was he was probably my least favorite enemy back in the day besides the final boss, just because I was not a fan of needles then. I'm not a fan now, but I can take them better. But, yeah, back then, just, like, you know, throwing those things like lawn darts at you, because they were pretty big too. That was just like, gigantic. No.
And also, he has, they have real range to them. Like, unlike a bullet that flies straight out, he can throw them, like, at angles. They'll, like, bounce around a little bit. Like, they're hard to dodge. So it's not easy. It's certainly a major level up from the first enemy who is barely a threat. This guy is much more dangerous. Also, you fight him in a drug lab where there's giant, like, bubbling beakers, which you can shoot and destroy for bonus points. Also, this is the first point when you start to see these dogs in the game. Dogs run on the screen, and it's kind of funny. You can shoot the dogs, and you have to, because otherwise they will eat you. But if you shoot the dogs, they don't die. They just turn into tiny dogs and run away. So the game gets a kindness, and that you can't actually kill any dogs in this game, but you have to defend yourself. So It's I guess they're magic bullets. I don't know.
Yeah, this was you started to seeing, I think around this time, people saying, "Hey, why are you murdering animals?" That goes all the way back to Phoenix, I think, in the 1970s, where people were complaining because you were just murdering animals in a video game. So there was always a lot of sensitivity to how violence against animals is portrayed. Not so much against people. You can blow them into little burning giblets. But animals, it's just uncool to kill those guys, even if it's self-defense.
Yeah. Sort of like these, like, Hulk dogs. And I guess, like, you're just sort of calming them down.
Yeah, I guess the bullets will do that. I assume a bullet. I've never been shot before. Maybe a bullet is just like going to sleep. Maybe it's
the ultimate pacifier. Ride in the park.
The game starts to introduce very big threats, and they start escalating. The next one is the Joe Rockhead, aka Dumpster Man, and I guess this is probably based on the urban legend of someone who took PCP and supposedly broke handcuffs, because he's a big, strong guy. And he has bullet holes in his portrait, and he takes many, many shots to shoot down with a regular gun, and he picks up stuff and throws them at you, trash cans, including, as his name suggests, dumpsters. He'll pick up dumpsters and throw them at you. You can't bust him, of course, because he would just break the cuffs, apparently.
Nah.
There's also killer clowns, which to me as a child never made sense, but I guess people already hated clowns, so I guess in that sense it made sense. According to Jarvis, he said that a mass murderer was in the news at the time, so I'm guessing he was probably talking about John Wayne Gacy, because he was more active in the 80s, or like early 80s, by the time they're making Narc, he was already on trial, and he was from Chicago, too. So a Chicago outfit, like, you know, Williams, Midway, Bally, whatever, they would definitely have, like, daily updates on Gacy, so I guess they figured, well, let's put a clown in our game. And he also can't be busted, so I guess he's on PCP? I don't know. It's very strange, the rules of this game. Like, the PCP guys cannot be busted, but you can kill them, and they're very aggressive. And in the case of the clown, when you meet him, it's on a stage with streetwalkers, sec workers, who are just marching along the streets, and he will kidnap them and take them away. So you have to rescue them by killing him. But you can't shoot them, because that's not allowed. And you get big bonuses again for saving the women as opposed to hurting them. But they're just kind of there, and you can walk up to them and they'll sort of like shimmy a little bit like Duke Nukem, and it's real weird. I mean, this is the point of my life when I'm starting to get horny, like, regularly. But even for me, I was kind of like, what are these women doing? Like, I don't know if I even picked up the fact they were supposed to be hookers, because I don't know if I knew what a hooker was.
Oh, good. I was worried I'd have to be the one to, like, confess that, and everybody just look at me like, what?
And I would say things only get weirder. Yeah, you start to have pimps who throw dynamite, and they also collect cash up the street. Interestingly, the arcade game does not identify these enemies at all, but the NES game calls them Bevan Face, so call it a retcon. You got Sergeant Sky High, who's basically a weed Rambo. He runs around with a giant, like, M60 machine gun. You can't bust him either, because he's too strong, but you can raid his domain, and it's full of just giant marijuana plants, which you can basically confiscate or bust, except some of them are booby-trapped and will explode, and I don't know if it's random or if it's just you have to really memorize, because there's a lot of them, and they're very close together, so if you just try to get them all, you will get blown up. I don't know what the strategy is there, but it's extremely hazardous. And in the late stages, you have the HQ posse, who are sort of like militarized goons. They have automatic weapons. They move in formations and attack together. So they're very dangerous if they hit you, because they'll hit you many times at once. However, if you can get around them and touch them, you can also bust them all at once, which, again, nets you huge bonuses. And usually they carry rockets. Some of them even fire rockets. So late in the game, even though you're really surrounded by a lot of threats at once, if you can bust those guys, it is a huge deal and very important to try and keep moving. Also, a weird fact of those last stages, you're sort of getting close to the main boss, and you're passing his banks, which have ATM machines. If you shoot the ATMs, cash falls out and you get more points. It's a cute little thing, like, to acknowledge the fact that there is money in this world and you can still take it, even though I don't think cops are supposed to rob ATMs. I don't know. I don't know if it's on the up and up, guys.
I mean, yeah. Okay. Never mind.
Robbing banks? Just say no. Collecting plants? Just say no.
No, I was just going to say police departments get a lot of their funding by just taking people's money, whether or not they are criminals or not. Yeah. It's kind of a thing you see commented on a lot these days. I don't know if it was necessarily the case back then, but I kind of feel like, yes, I kind of feel like, you know, the problems that we have with a lot of police these days are just amplified versions of problems that we've always had with police, which is that not all of them are in it for the good of the common people. It's some of them are just there to enrich themselves or, you know, hurt people.
Flex.
Well, Jeremy, it's funny you brought that up. I sort of glossed over it earlier, but in fact, in 1984, Ronald Reagan signs the Comprehensive Crime Control Act. And one of the major aspects of that law is creates what's called equitable sharing. And that allows law enforcement to share proceeds from seizures they make during arrests with federal agencies, which indeed makes it profitable for law enforcement to seize high-profile items like homes and cars and anything they view that might have been purchased with funds from drugs. And this is during the arrest. It doesn't have to come. You don't have to be convicted to keep that stuff. So indeed, there is actual motivation for them to pursue high profile cases and get the money. And they keep the money. It's real. And that's Reagan. I'm sorry. This is not made up. This is not made up. So it absolutely was a thing at the time.
I mean, I guess it explains the fancy sports cars.
Exactly. Porsches don't grow on trees. Well, actually, in this game, they almost do on trees. You have so many Porsches. But
they just show up on bridges randomly.
So when the game comes to an end, you actually go into the inner sanctum of Crack. Yes, the bad guys you're fighting this game are all called Crack. That's an acronym. K-R-A-K, Crack. And your target is the elusive Mr. Big, who is the leader of Crack. And to get him, you have to fight your way through, I think, three solid levels of just pack-to-pack, and just tons of enemies and dogs, and just the worst congestion. And when you fight Mr. Big, he's just a little guy, actually. He's a little guy in a wheelchair. But he's very fast, and he's got machine guns, and it's actually very hard to hit him. So you need to use your rockets and knock him out of the chair. And if you do this three times, he will drop dead, and you get his gold card, and you get to escape. And it's funny because this comes out about a year before Final Fight gave us that last boss, who was also a wheelchair guy who fired a gun very fast. Although in his case, he was just faking it because eventually he hops on the wheelchair, and he's very mobile, so he didn't need that wheelchair at all. Mr. Big maybe needed it, although he's not actually dead when you knock him out of the chair. So, question mark.
Yeah, I wonder if this is some sort of reference to something or someone. I looked up to try to see if I could find, you know, 1980s drug lords who were famous for having been wheelchair bound. I couldn't find any. I guess there's Ernst Stavro Blofeld from James Bond. But he didn't really run around, you know, like zip around shooting things. He mostly just kind of sat there with a cat and then fell into a chimney pipe. But yeah, maybe
unidentified end for Blofeld.
Maybe they were just predicting Tio Salamanca from Breaking Bad. I don't know.
Or maybe this inspired him.
You know, I should point out that Leonard Part 6 came out in 1986. And in that movie, one of the bad guys is in a wheelchair. He only has one line. He always says, kill him. And he does use a gun. And then eventually, I think Bill Cosby knocks him off his wheelchair, and his legs stay in the wheelchair, but his torso falls off and he dies. It could happen. Could happen.
A classic of cinema.
But yes, Mr. Big does not die when you kill him, because that's how Mr. Big, that's not how Mr. Big rolls. And I would say the last boss fight of Narc, I think it's truly one of the ages. I think it's one of the all-time WTF moments. Certainly for me as a young person, finally getting to the end of this game, I never would have expected this, because Mr. Big comes back and he is a giant head on a silver disc. And when I say giant head, I mean he is three times taller than your human being character. So, I don't know, like 10 feet, 12 feet tall, let's say?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I mean, yeah, he's a big guy who consists entirely of a head. It's like a statue or something that he had erected to himself that then becomes a weapon, or like an oversized Elias Big Boy mascot. I don't know.
So I was never I always thought the guy in the wheelchair was like a decoy and that the head was the real Mr. Big. So
could be.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's like a Sigma situation where he's just like, you know, hopping bodies, or if it's, you know, like, who is the real Mr. Big, I guess.
Well, if nothing else, the head certainly talks, so it is definitely a living being. And as the fight goes on, you can blow parts of it off, including the skin. So eventually it just becomes a skull and a spine dragging itself around. So it's also organic, but it keeps fighting. It keeps fighting until you keep shooting it. And eventually, it all catches on fire and makes a lot of jet engine noises and explodes, and the skull cracks open and bugs fly out of it.
I'm going to have to take your word for that, because I could never beat that thing, and I believe
really?
You're going to go over why. I've fought it several times, but no. Yeah, I don't want to step on your toes here, but yeah, it's like, you know, you fight them, and if you lose, then you really lose.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, this game is fairly generous. Again, like I said, the extra lives come in handy. You can, you have a life bar. It's not even when it kills. You have a life bar that goes down. You take a fair amount of hits. But during this final battle, if you don't have a second player, they can't join in. And if you lose all your lives, you're allowed to continue, but you just start the fight over, which means Mr. Big goes back to full health. So you cannot buy your way through this fight. You cannot just rocket spam your way through the fight. You have to survive. You have to do it right. Now, obviously, if you build up a lot of lives, you can use those lives and the free rockets you get with each live, you know, to your benefit. But if you run out of lives, that's it. You have to try again from the beginning. Not from the wheelchair stage, from the head stage. But still, the head is very dangerous. It's very large. It moves fairly quickly. If the head touches you, you, like, explode. It's like an explosion sound occurs. Like, the silver disc is somehow hazardous to your health. I don't know. It must be covered in drugs. I guess it's made of drugs.
I mean, I feel like the explanation for this entire final battle is that it doesn't really happen, and that after, you know, 8 levels of blowing up drug runners, you've experienced a contact high, and this is just a hallucination. You're, like, in your fugue state. That's where I'm going with it.
Oh, that makes me feel better. So I actually beat the game then. The rest doesn't matter. It's not real.
It's you grappling with your inner demons as you face the truth about yourself while high out of your mind.
Oh, I guess I lost after all.
Well, as a capper to the game, if you successfully kill Mr. Big, you get to loot his gold bars. So the very last end of the game is just the one player or two players running to the right and getting as much gold as you possibly can. At this point, if I was playing with somebody, I did try to shoot them because then I could steal more gold. Because at this point, I learned that the best strategy in life is to get as much gold as possible. And at the very end of the game, there's not really end of the game, but there is a text screen, which again, I hope this is a joke, but it didn't feel like a joke to me as a kid. And it said, "You've completed the Narc training mission. Contact your local DEA recruiter." So again, in the narrative of this world, drug dealers and everyone associated with them are to be killed. And that's what the DEA does. So kids, this game is all fun and games, but if you like this, you should probably get into law enforcement and kill drug dealers. And I'm just, I don't know. I really don't know if that was a joke. I honestly don't know.
I would honestly love to know the number of people who actually saw that and, like, you know, enrolled or applied or sought out a recruiter.
I feel like it probably wasn't very many, but I feel like this is just the Fourth Amendment violating version of The Last Starfighter.
I mean, to put it bluntly, I would say a lot of 80s movies and TV shows had a lot of propaganda, and drug dealers were a popular enemy. So, especially because the late 80s, by the late 80s, we knew that we couldn't keep doing with the Cold War stuff. We had to find a new enemy. So, drug lords and their minions became popular, you know, foils. I mean, in 1989, James Bond fought drugs, and he hated drugs. He stabs it in the movie. He hates it so much. He's stabbing the drugs. He goes crazy.
Which movie was that?
That was License to Kill.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that one.
It's a good one. I like it.
You're busted. You're busted.
But as far as we can tell, NARC did pretty well. Jarvis estimated about 3,700 cabinets were in circulation. I certainly saw this game everywhere. I saw it in so many places. I even saw it like in remote areas when I went on vacation. It was a very distinct cabinet. You know, as we said, it was all black, had the characters on the side. The joystick setup was very big. The speakers were very big, and all the sounds of this game are just rocking. The music is, I think the music of this game is great. So it's like, I feel like if you play this game or if you're near someone playing this game, it is just an auditory explosion. Even if you don't see the graphics, you're inundated with screams and explosions and little like, busted, you're busted. The attract mode uses all voice samples from the game to make it sort of like, it's not quite a rap, but it's kind of like a spoken word jazz fusion, like freestyle thing, like just a bunch of random sounds stitched together.
Hey kids, do some drugs.
Yeah, the theme song was, I remember liking that one a lot. And yeah, it's got the voice clips, kind of like a remix thing.
Yeah, and it was, you know, because it was so successful, we know it was ported to many home computers at the time and the NES. And as we said earlier, a lot of these versions, none of them have digitized graphics. That's for certain. All of them have just, you know, cartoon graphics. Some versions look more accurate than others. I think the Commodore version looks pretty good. The Amiga version sounds pretty good. But really, from a gameplay standpoint, it's really hard to get all those buttons. You know, again, jump button, crouch button, gun button, and rocket button are all separate commands. So you've got to really juggle your inputs very carefully here. Also surprisingly, because this is, you know, for an NES game, the NES was still very much during Nintendo's notorious, you know, we want no adult content in this game, you know, on our system whatsoever. The NES version sticks pretty close to the arcade game in that they have no blood, but they still have rockets and people still blow up. But I guess it's a little more Looney Tunes, a little more cartoonish. And the evil organization has been changed from Crack to Quack. So you can't say Crack. But otherwise, the manual very clearly, you know, establishes that this is about drugs and you're fighting against drugs. So I guess it's viewed as an anti-drug message. So I feel like the NES game certainly has no irony whatsoever because it's very much about no drugs. Drugs are bad. Shoot the drugs, kids. Shoot them up.
I remember it seemed to be pretty heavily advertised in comic books and stuff, too.
Yeah, I think by all accounts, I don't know if it sold well, but it certainly was pushed as a major release because the arcade game was such a big hit. And also, I mean, related to that, I would say the show didn't last long, but the lead, the two heroes of NARC officially are called Max Force and Hitman. So Max Force, the blue guy, was even in a cartoon, the short-lived Power Team, which was basically a bunch of acclaimed wannabes, and it was run on, what was that show? Like, I think it was called Video Power, right. Not great. No, history does not miss this cartoon, and it did not run very long, but it's
a, you know, weird combination of characters. You've got
very
this guy, and you've got Kuros from Wizards and Warriors, and you've got Quirk, the puzzle-solving tomato. That's and that's
Bigfoot.
Not your...
Bigfoot the car. Bigfoot the car, right, not yes. the animal.
Yes. That, like, if you got that party in an RPG, you would be like, I'm not playing this RPG anymore.
There was also Tyrone from Arch Rivals. And yes. Yeah, basically they were all Acclaim characters or, like, you know, licensed through Acclaim. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting thing to look back at.
I believe Acclaim was the publisher of Wizards and Warriors, even though Rare was the developer. Mm-hmm. I think that's correct. How it worked. Yep. Also important, because as I mentioned, we already mentioned the Mortal Kombat connection, but I didn't know this until reading up on this. So because NARC used so much digitized graphics and high resolution, you know, high resolution images, NARC was the centerpiece of their pitch to James Cameron when they wanted to get the Terminator 2 license. And by all accounts, Cameron loved it. And he gave them and let them do whatever they wanted. So, you know, eventually you had the T2 shooter game, which had a lot of digitized graphics. And you had the T2 pinball game, which had clips from the actual movie. And, you know, both did very well. Both were seen everywhere. So NARC was, if perhaps a small part, a part of that game coming together. So, you know, it has a long legacy, even if you never played it.
Another part of it is... I remember it has like a blink and you'll miss it cameo of the Mr. Big battle in the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie in the warehouse where all the kids before they join up with the Foot Clan and they're just, you know, kind of indoctrinating them. So, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like NARC and RoboCop were two arcade cabinets that showed up in a lot of movies. Also Bad Dudes. I feel like Data East, I think Data East and Acclaim both knew they could get a lot of free real estate that way. Oh, you got a fight scene? Well, here's some cabinets. Put them in the background. They're okay. Oh my god, I think Death Wish 4 has a scene in an arcade, and it's like, it's packed with arcade games, and I tried to pause it to see what they all were. There might be in the background there, because Death Wish 4 is like late 80s, maybe even 1990, so NARC was out by that point. You were saying, Jeremy.
Nothing of value.
Okay. Yeah, this is Midway exclusive, baby. The way I'm pushing you has been crucial lately. So why these fans, they always stunning on me. Takes half of the fee to take half of the weed. Like negotiations, they always waiting to bust ya. Hey, assholes who's always diving through customs. All the haters, I'm really just wanting to bust one. See, competition, they claim it's something but bluff. Well, what a speaking of nothing of value, Jeremy. There's another video game we've talked about, perhaps briefly, but we can't ignore it. We have to, we do. Because in the early 2000s, Williams, Bally, Midway, whatever you call it, they're all basically folded in one corporate umbrella at this point. And it's the PlayStation 2 era, it's the Xbox era, and it's a time when publishers are mining their back catalogs and figuring out, what do we own? What do we own? What can we put on these new consoles and, you know, make a buck? And in some cases, it's porting these games directly, because NARC was included on several, you know, arcade compilations at this time. But Midway also did sort of, you know, reboots or reimaginings, whatever you want to call them, of a lot of their classic arcade games. And NARC was among that list. So in 2005, we got NARC. Same name, but wow, different game, to put it mildly. Because, let's face it, it's 2005, so what's in vogue? Arcade shooters? No. What's in vogue is Grand Theft Auto. So, someone in a boardroom somewhere decided, well, here's our ticket. We'll take the world of NARC and drugs, and we'll make a gritty crime-fighting game about being a cop and dealing drugs and taking the drugs. Because in this version, the drugs are not just evidence to collect. The drugs are power-ups. You can take the drugs and you get unique effects that last for a short time. And if you take too many drugs, you get addicted, and there's a whole mini-game where you have to come down from the drugs or else you get in trouble. I'm not making any of this up. I swear this is a real video game. It actually went on
sale. Grand Theft Auto borrowed back that idea for getting drunk in GTA 4.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Like, a lot of video games have, like, alcohol mechanics. Certainly the Yakuza games, you can get drunk in those games. And it's just, it's a visual thing. You know, your controller vibrates. And I think you can equip certain items that make you more powerful when you're drunk. And, like, or even do, like, drunken boxing. Like, it's a joke. But again, is it satire? Is it real? I don't think it's a satire. I think someone, like, they just had a meeting. And it's like, okay, what can the drugs do? All right. Well, you know, when you smoke pot, it, like, things seem to be going slow motion. What if the game goes in slow motion when you smoke pot? Or what if you take speed and your cop runs faster? He's faster now because he's on speed. You get it? Like, very first draft jokes. I'm sorry. Like, it's just, it's real. Like, and crack. Oh, my God. Crack. If you take crack, it means you're a crack shot and you do more damage.
I never got to play this one, but
no.
Well, what if you take pot and speed together?
I don't know if you're allowed to mix drugs. I think I'm assuming one cancels the other out. I mean, certainly I can tell you in my experience when I've taken more than one drug, one works and the other goes away. So I'm assuming it works the same way in NARC. have some quotes here. Some quotes from some how about the vice president of marketing, Helen Sheeler, who says, following a deep and twisted story that drives the character player control, NARC challenges gamers to bust and kill ruthless thugs and criminals in order to bring justice to the drug-infested streets. By which she means, in the video game, you arrest people for having drugs, but also you can sell the drugs yourself. You can do both of these things at the same time. And, you know, GTA, you're not a cop in GTA, and if you get in trouble, the cops chase you. In this game, how it works is your cop has a badge reputation. And if you do good stuff like arrest people, the badge number goes up. And if you do bad stuff like random violence or selling drugs or taking too many drugs, then your number goes down. And eventually you can get demoted or even arrested. But it's like if your badge number goes down and you're demoted, you can't do any more missions. So if you want to play the game, you have to put the number back up to proceed. So it's kind of an empty, like, it's not like a Mass Effect thing where you can be like good cop or bad cop. You have to be a sufficient level of good cop to actually play the game in any meaningful way. Unless you just literally just want to run around and do the drugs and shoot people at random, because you can do that forever if you want.
Yeah, I was going to say, someone played KOTOR and was like, hey, that seems like a good idea. Let's not put any real thought into how to integrate this.
So if you run out of points, like, you know, what do they do? Like, put you on parking meter duty, or?
Eventually they'll just arrest you. Like, they'll just keep arresting you. Like, you'll become an enemy.
Which is not how it works in real life anymore.
No, unfortunately not. And that's the thing, yeah, I mean, honestly, playing this game, watching this game today, it is almost ludicrous in that you've got the two main characters are a dirty cop who's coming back from addiction and a straight-laced DEA guy who are forced to work together. And it's just, it's all very rote. It's the script is terrible. They hired real actors. To their credit, they spent money on this. They hired real actors. Like, the game plays okay. Like, the controls are not terrible. The graphics are, I would say, bad, but not, like, ludicrously bad for the time. Like, they're decent for the time.
They're very of the era. Like, you know, kind of C-tier GTA clone. There were so many of those. It's
right.
Exactly what you'd expect.
Like, to me, it's ugly, but it's not uniquely ugly in a way that I would say, oh my god, this game sucks. It's an ugly game like so many ugly games of 2005.
Yeah, the real ugliness is in its soul.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm surprised to hear it had a budget for that stuff, because as I recall, one of the their pushes for marketing it was that it was $19.99, like, at launch.
Yes, and it was sold at a deep discount price. Absolutely,
yeah. To the point where they even, like, I believe stamped it on the front of the box, and that was a problem when I was working at Blockbuster, and they were selling games as well as renting, and we got copies in. And up here in Canada, the pricing is a little bit different, so they kind of ran into a problem where it's like, okay, we're trying to charge $29.99 for this game that says $19.99 stamped right on the front of the case, and eventually they had to just, like, drop the price because, I don't think you can do that.
Whiskey bottles and brand new cars, oak tree, you're in my way. There's too much coke and too much smoke. Look what's going on inside you.
I have no inside information, but my suspect reasoning here is that I think Midway announced this back in early, I think 2003, and intended to release it in 2004, but it didn't come out till March 2005. And as we all know, March is the end of the fiscal year. So I suspect someone said, this game is taking too long. Just ship it already. We already paid for all these licenses. It has a ton of licensed music. It has real actors who, I mean, look, I'll be honest. They're not doing their best, but they are actual actors from movies that you've seen and probably heard of. So, like, you know, Michael Madsen had been in a lot of Tarantino movies and GTA 3. Ron Perlman's a legend. We support Ron Perlman on this podcast. Michael Wincott, one of the great voices of all time. You know, one of the evil guys in Robin Hood. You heard him in Nope. He was the cinematographer guy in Nope who had, like, the handheld camera. So, a great actor, really. Like, he's a great actor. But in this game, he's playing a dying old man, and his performance is somehow even less energetic than you'd expect. And it's just, I'm sorry, it's just, it's really low effort on that regard. And also, it's like, it's a GTA clone, and there's no cars. You never drive anywhere. You have to explore the city on foot. It's such a strange number of choices that are made here. You know, you're on foot most of the time. You're busting. They want to keep the busting mechanic, so you have a lot of, like, melee combat and punches and kicks and a meter that fills up. And if you have max meter, you can super bust someone, which is like you do a wrestling move on them and, like, break their neck, but Ooh. Then you arrest them and it, like,
double bust.
Yeah, it's real bad. I'm sorry. It's real 6 out of 10 material.
You don't get a fancy sports car? Even the original had a fancy sports car. How do you leave that out?
No cars. No cop cars, no cars whatsoever. No vans, no buses, no scooters, no bikes. And, like, again, this is 2005. This is post-Vice City. It is the same year as San Andreas. And, like, I've got my problems with San Andreas. But San Andreas gives you a laundry list of things you can do in this game, you know? And in NARC, it's like, you could do the missions, or you could sell the drugs, or you can play, I think, a 3-card Monty minigame if you want, and then bust the guy who plays the game. But, like, they don't even go for the sex worker angle. Like, they're not even edgy in that regard. Like, the whole drug thing is, like, that's their whole ticket. And I feel like they really counted on this being, like, a bigger news story, but I don't think it really was, outside of, like, Games Press, who basically said, it's not a great game, don't buy it, and that was the end of it, I feel. I don't know if you heard otherwise, but...
I was in the Games Press. I was in the Games Press, and no one wanted to talk about this. We were all just okay. Like, this is horrible. No.
I guess it's like they want Grand Theft Auto, like, you know, attention and money and stuff, but instead of going for, like, all the crimes like Grand Theft Auto, they just kind of focused on their niche. Drugs are our niche.
I think they definitely counted on more controversy and more sort of shocking stuff. Because, again, it's still the early aughts. There's still a hangover from that, you know, extreme in-your-face kind of attitude. I mean, you know, I'm sure the magazine ad was very tasteful, I'm saying. But, yeah, critics at the time did not receive it very well. I have an IGN quote from Ivan Sulik, who called it a dark, twisted, offensive, and morally vacant game. The late Ryan Davis for GameSpot said, you know, he wrote a negative review and said that it carries the same name as an enjoyable and knowingly bizarre arcade classic is downright misleading. Because there's just nothing fun here. I mean, maybe you might enjoy the actual gameplay, maybe, but the game itself just has no sense of humor like, say, a Saints Row. Like, Saints Row is Grand Theft Auto, but silly. Jovial, but ridiculous, and you're a criminal, and you're doing over-the-top stuff. Like, that's what you want in your over-the-top GTA game. Not this. This bleak, just downbeat, lifeless crap. It's crap. I'm sorry, it's crap. It's crap.
It's mean-spirited and yes. joyless. It's terrible. Like, whatever flaws the original NARC had in terms of tone and subtext... this just doesn't offer anything redeeming. It's so bad. Like a power glove.
I'm curious, and I almost hate to ask, but were any of the, like, original main principal developers of the original NARC involved in this?
I don't believe so.
I'm pretty sure all of them had left by that point. Oh. Certainly the credit, Midway's the publisher, but they're not the developer. It's depending which version, the developers are credited as Viz Entertainment or Point of View, because there was more than one version. This game came out for PS2 and Xbox and later came to PC, Windows. So depending on which version you played, there might have been a different studio actually handling that version of the game. But either case, Midway did not develop it. They were the publisher. So I really doubt anyone from the 80s was still in on the project. And indeed, we had a quote from Jarvis who just said, it died a well-deserved death. So he certainly viewed this as nothing worthwhile. Time to come down from the high of talking about classic arcade games and their misfire reboots of the early aughts. I personally, even though I do have to wonder what kind of energy was put into the making of NARC, I still hold an incredible amount of affection for NARC as an arcade game. It's a cabinet that whenever I see it, I almost always put a coin into it, because as I said earlier, while I'm certainly not good enough to beat it on one single coin, I can get a lot of time for my single coin. And it's such an absurd game. Even though you don't move very fast, it's very fast paced. There's lots of enemies coming at you at all times. The music, the explosions, it's visually and audio kind of overstimulation. And, you know, kid, adult me, doesn't matter. We both kind of love it. So I still really enjoy NARC, and It almost adds disappointment, the fact that they couldn't come up with a decent idea to make something fun out of NARC on PlayStation 2. Because a lot of PlayStation 2 games, you know, are secret treasures of experimentation. Not this NARC. In this case, the good NARC is the one we all remember, and the bad NARC is the one that we kind of forgot.
I like to think the original NARC was high energy.
I don't actually like either of the games. I have okay. No fondness for any of them. I just find this topic interesting, and it's just very much a slice of history, a product of its time. And, you know, I don't begrudge anyone who enjoys the game. I won't say games, because no one likes NARC 2005. But it's weird, because you can kind of see the shape of the future of American society in there. And there was a lot kind of building up to that. But this does feel like one of those, like, you know, milestones where you're like, oh, huh, I see how things are going.
You know, bringing things back around to something we were discussing earlier, were either of these games released in Japan?
I seriously doubt it. I don't think the arcade game was. Certainly, the NES game was NES only, not Famicom. And I can't even imagine the 2005 game even coming within a country mile of the border. I mean, like, the Grand Theft Auto games were eventually released in Japan. They were localized by Capcom, in fact, because yeah. Capcom and Rockstar had, I guess, a relationship. But I think a game where you play a criminal is one thing, but a game that's all about drug dealing and drug taking, I feel like that would like explode some heads down at Zero rating board. So I feel like there's no way they would get away with that.
Yeah, I just feel like the first one, the arcade game, just seems kind of in line with their take on things.
Well, I think part of the problem is that the cabin itself was this bespoke thing. So I don't know how many. I mean, maybe some got over here because, you know, those cabinets went around the world eventually. But I can't imagine, you know, you can't just send a board out. You'd want to have the whole thing to get the full attention. And like, if you just put this into a sit down, whatever, candy cab, I think a lot of it would just be lost, you know?
I can see that.
Yeah, this is a game that's very much not in line with Japanese aesthetics and design.
That's right. There's also dismemberment, which does not go well in Japan either. So.
Oh, yeah, good point.
So, on that note of what is and is not allowed in Japan, I've determined it's almost my bedtime in Japan, so we're going to wrap things up here. Thank you very much for joining us here on Retronauts. We really appreciate your listening to the podcast. If you listen to the show for free, thank you so much for listening to Retronauts. However, I might add that if you go to patreon.com/retronauts, you can support this show, and we need your support to keep things going. For $3 a month, you get everything 1 week early, higher bitrate, and ad-free. But for $5 a month, which is just $2 more than the first number I said, oh boy, you get a lot more stuff. You get exclusive episodes, 2 exclusive episodes every month, sometimes 3 if there's enough Fridays. You get weekly columns from me, and I read you the column as a mini podcast. You get a monthly community show, also hosted by me. And you get Discord access, where I'm at, and Jeremy, and a lot of other listeners. We all hang out in there. It's kind of a fun place. I imagine when this episode hits, we'll be talking to the Discord, and we'll be having a jovial time about, you know, cops that came to our school and said silly things, or maybe about, you know, where we saw a narco cane, what it made us feel like, and did we enjoy it? Did we ever see a real cop drive a Porsche? You know, there'll be any, we'll go whole ham on it, you know? Any number of topics might come up there. It's a wild place, our Discord, but a friendly place. Patreon.com/retronauts, if you please, we really appreciate that. David, you're the least retronaut of all of us, so why don't you go next?
Okay then. I guess if people are interested in following my hijinks, I'm on social media at LBD_NYTETRAYN, except without the underscore on Blue Sky because they don't do underscores there. And I don't do Blue Sky as much, so maybe forget that part. A lot of my activity you can find at the Mega Man Network, which is the mmnetwork.com, and the MM Network on socials as well. And occasionally I write something else on poisonmushroom.org, and I do some contributions for Nintendo Force. And my wife, another retronaut, I believe, yes, Nadia, she's streams with me periodically on our Twitch at Nightworks. That's NYTEWORKS.
David, I'm so glad you had to think about spelling it, because I never remember how to spell your username when I have to write up a tweet or something that mentions you, and I have to, like, look it up. I never get it right.
It's a very 90s distinct version of Night Train, like the songs. So
I get it. Helps. I get it. It's like you don't want to pay Guns N' Roses, but you want to have the Night Train. I understand.
Yeah, I was doing it before Mega Man X5.
Wonderful. Jeremy, how about you? What do you want to tell people?
You can find me on the internet doing all kinds of things, such as Retronauts, working at Limited Run Games, and on YouTube making videos and books. The books aren't actually on YouTube, but you know. Anyway, yeah, that's all very exciting, and you can find me. Just look for Jeremy Parrish.
And I'm your host, Diamond Fight. You can find me on the internet by going to my website, fightclub.me. That's F-E-I-T, my last name, C-L-U-B, a dark place where you might have taken drugs in your life, .me. Me, because Fight Club's me. That's the joke. All the socials as well. But again, it's all linked to the website. Just go to the website. It's okay. And on that note, I'll say goodnight to everybody. And by all means, don't do drugs if they're illegal. And if they are illegal, don't do too many.